Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start with Marnie in Felton, who sent an email. Subject: fibromuscular dysplasia. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Just found you again after many years. I had a heart attack 3 years ago and was then diagnosed with fibromuscular dysplasia, trying to figure out the best course of action and what you might know about it. Local cardiologists are just doing the regular Band-Aid regimen, and I feel like I'm missing something. Well, Marnie, we all are. And I, when fibromuscular dysplasia passed my eyes in your subject heading, I'm like, wait a minute, click, click, click. Oh, wait, that's a young person's disease. That's sort of something I learned about a long time ago and have never seen a case of. And typically it's young people, especially young women. They have about a 2-to-1 risk compared to men. And they present with something surprising, a heart attack, you know, at 32, or a stroke. And you, of course, they check the cholesterol and it's fine. And they're like, what up? Well, what up is a mysterious disease. We have no idea what causes it. We have no idea exactly what's going on. But we've got plenty of slides of pathological specimens, so we can describe it really well. And this is one of those diseases where everything we know about the disease is basically a description of the weird thing that the disease does without actually having any idea what to do about it. And what it is it's scar tissue forming in the middle layer of the blood vessels. Now, except for capillaries, blood vessels have three layers. They have an outer layer. They have a media. The outer layer is called the intima. Then you've got a media. Then you've got an endothelial layer. All right. And the endothelial layer is, we used to think it was just a lining. It's actually metabolically active, makes nitric oxides, controls blood pressure. And we've chatted about that before on this program. And actually, the first thing that happens while we're on endothelium, the first thing that happens is, in most people, the first symptom, if you have a penis, is erectile dysfunction, because you're not able to pump that puppy up the way you used to be. And that, now that we have drugs for it, generally prompts a visit to the doctor. And if the doctor knows their stuff, they do some testing to see whether you have a problem with your endothelium. And that's a whole different category. Back to your question. The muscle layer, the media, gets scar tissue in fibromuscular dysplasia. In other words, the muscle gets fibrotic. Now, muscle is a nice tissue. It expands, it contracts, it changes shape. Fibrous tissue is designed not to do any of those things. So a better way of putting it to the layperson would be, you have scar tissue in the muscle of your blood vessels. And that causes the blood vessels not to work as well. It causes them to narrow. And it may have nothing to do with your heart attack. Your heart attack might be just an incidentaloma, as we call it. So they found it, among other things, they had pathological specimens, I assume. Or maybe they did some sort of scan that I don't know about, but they were able to make that diagnosis. You should probably, if you've not already had done it, have your carotids and your kidneys checked, because it's those tissues that typically get damaged in this disease, not the heart itself, although that can happen, and people do get heart attacks. The fact that this, in fact, this causes increased strokes, and that's often how it presents, as a stroke in a young person. It can also cause aortic dissection, also not a young person's disease. And so I wonder, do you have other risk factors? I don't quite know how old you are, Marnie, but if you've got other risk factors besides older age, maybe a history of smoking or a family history of heart attacks in women or something like that, maybe that has something to do with the situation. But I do have some good news for you. Likely, as I said earlier, your case is just an incidentaloma. And most people who have fibromuscular dysplasia who are over 65 are actually asymptomatic. It's not as aggressive. Just like cancer when you're older, it's less aggressive. Maybe it's more common. In this case, this disease is not. And there's a lower probability of rapid progression. But it is important that your kidney functions be monitored and the appropriate testing be done by a nephrologist, and you absolutely need to get your carotids checked. We have a lot of non-invasive testing like MR angiography. Magnetic resonance angiography is awesome. And we also have tests that we can do with MR that will really tell us about the health of internal tissues, so we don't have to stick a needle in them to get those lovely pathological specimens. And that's something we should all celebrate. This next one comes from an anonymous in Santa Cruz. Dear Dr. Dawn, I emailed you some time ago because of my early morning night sweats that also sometimes occur up to an hour after eating, not spicy foods. I'm 64, female, eat a healthy organic. Blood sugar was ruled out from being monitored. You addressed also stress levels. This is a follow-up to a previous email, if that's not obvious. But I do not lead a stressful life. I know you can't diagnose on the air, but here are two interesting, unique aspects of my sweat that I think you might have thoughts about. Whenever I've had acupuncture for these, the results were horrible. Normally, these sweats are sudden, onset, and fast. Every time I've tried acupuncture with different acupuncturists, months and years apart, these sweats have become very slow, like I'm a lobster and being slow cooked. I really wish you had told me how long that effect lasts. But going on. Number two, whenever I have a sweat, my outer body temperature doesn't change. I tend to run cold mid-high 97s to low 98s. Actually, Annie Anonymous, that is absolutely normal, turns out. The 98.6 was actually happened back in the 19th century when there were a whole lot of people who had tuberculosis, and therefore a certain small percentage of the population was undiagnosed and running a temperature, so they brought up the average. And now that we started checking everybody's temperatures obsessively for a couple of years, we had a data set from brought to you as a COVID bonus, and we now know that 97.5 is pretty much the population average for temperature. But my temperature doesn't change, even though it feels like I'm running a high fever at that time. Do either of these mean anything to you? Thanks for this and all that you give. Well, first of all, you mentioned that it sometimes occurs about an hour after eating. And that made me think of something that hadn't registered before when I answered your question, Annie. And that's histamine. So, and the fact that it gets weird after acupuncture could also point to histamine, especially if you had high levels of histamine in your skin, which can happen sometimes if people have food sensitivities. So I'm still not entirely sure that your perception that you have a low stress life entirely rules out stress. And here's why. Stress hormones can actually be silent. And furthermore, as I talked about, I think last week, there's a certain percentage of people who have those, what we used to call incidental omas in their adrenal glands. You know, no big deal. You got an MRI, there's an adenoma there. No, it's not a problem. Turns out about 20% of them actually produce hormones. So I think we have to not ignore those anymore. I don't know if you have one, but it's certainly on the list. Now, to find out if you had an adrenal incidental oma, you could get a urine 24-hour collection and have hormones and hormone metabolites measured. I'm sure that's very expensive, unless you've got really good insurance. But the commercial labs that test that in the functional medicine world will charge you about $150 for that test. So maybe that's in your price range. I don't know. You can get a hold of me at my office here in town. Since you're in Santa Cruz, I'm sure you can find me. And you will be able, I will set you up with that test. And we'll, after you get the results, if you go there, I'll help you interpret them. Coming back to the histamine, because I do think that's worth a little more discussion. Many people develop food sensitivities and or are breathing a lot of pollen, and they will, or sometimes that can be dust mites, any of the things that, that will raise your allergies and raise the allergic reaction in the system, will deposit histamine sometimes in your skin. That makes your skin very reactive. And the fact that you get the flushing after eating is a classic histamine reaction. What's going on here? Your body may not be able to break down the histamine fast enough. And so it would be really interesting to take a look at when you do get one of these reactions after eating, take a photo of what you ate and then check that against the tables you can find on the internet of high histamine containing foods. And if you don't get it help there, you might try an elimination diet, something that takes away the standard things people get sensitive to, and that would include wheat, eggs, corn, soy, oranges, and there's a few other things. The elimination diet is widely available on the internet, and you want one that gets those nine basic foods. One last thing. You talked about this acupuncture reaction, and I want to talk about what traditional Chinese medicine would say about flushing. And they would talk about an imbalance between the yin, which is the cooling, dark, soft part of the energy, and the yang, which is the warm, hard, warming, aggressive energy. And as women age, their yin decreases. Among other things, they get drier in all the wrong places. And their yang then can overcome the yin. It's supposed to be a dynamic balance with the yin holding down the yang and the yang holding down the yin, and they kind of arm wrestle. But if the kidney yang gets too strong, because the kidney yang is too weak to balance it, you get flushing. And so a yin yang imbalance is a strong possibility here. And that, since, and the fact that you got some weird, that acupuncture touched it, that it changed it, to me that says, because I'm absolutely sure when you go in with that set of symptoms, I know what points that the person would go for. And so I'm looking at that going, I bet they hit kidney 1, kidney 6, large intestine 4. I bet that didn't work, but it did shift it. So it tells me that maybe we're onto something following the TCM path. And you need to get your pulses checked by someone who knows how to do pulse diagnosis. I would suggest a herbalist, TCM, that's traditional Chinese medicine, but also there's lots of people who have doctorates locally from Five Branches University. Five Branches has a student clinic, but the students are supervised. So you would probably, with a symptom like this, the teacher would also check your pulses. And they have a sliding scale. Anyway, I think you should think about seeing if you can get in there. I'm not sure what their COVID rules are. I haven't taught there for easily 5 years, so I'm not up to date on their protocols. But I bet you could get some help from that if my thoughts about the histamine don't work out. And you might want to try that first, because finding out you have an adrenal incidentaloma leads it, as a cause for this, would lead to, you know, surgery. So you probably don't want that. If you can find a way to balance it using something benign like traditional Chinese herbal medicine, go for it. And it's a lot in that might be the first place to go of the things I've listed here. So please let us know how that works. If that's helpful, I would love to know how you're going. So please send a follow-up note. This week was an interesting week. We were flooded with people trying to get tested, long lines, as you say. We've got some good news in that there are three places that are that you can go for testing, and there's lots of places you can go for vaccination. All this information is at santacruzhealth.org. And I'm not going to go into detail, but we have testing centers open in Santa Cruz Monday through Friday, on Center Street, something called the Freight Depot, and I don't have the address memorized. And there's testing. There's testing in Watsonville, and that's from Monday through Sunday. Wednesday through Sunday, and that's 7 to 7. So please don't think you can't get tested. Yes, you might have to stand in line. It's not even raining, folks. Just if you can isolate and wait, maybe you don't need to get tested. But if you need to go somewhere and you need to, then at least get tested. The turnaround time is up to 3 days. It hasn't been worse than that unless you catch a weekend. But you can get in there. You can get tested. So I just want people to be aware of that. And what do you do if you do get COVID now, right? What's up with these new drugs? Well, first, I'm going to address the immunosuppressed, the cancer, the people on chemo, the transplant patients, and those on disease-modifying agents for rheumatoid diseases like lupus. By the way, if you're taking a disease-modifying agent, an immunosuppressant for psoriasis, just stop that right now, okay? Better ugly than dead. That's my motto. Now, let's stop for a moment because I do want to let you know the phones are now open, 831-900-5773. That's 900-KSQD. So give me a call, like I said, if it's burning on your lips, and send me an email if it's burning on the tips of your fingers. So there, right now, the new drugs that have just come out are being essentially given to you. You have one of those conditions I just mentioned, and you are within 5 days of a positive test, you can get those drugs. And that's talking in our community. These drugs are available. They're in the pharmacies. There's two oral drugs. They're outpatient. You don't need injections. They can be they have to be started within 5 days. And we have them, Paxlovid and Molnupiravir. And we've got them. So let's start with that. Tell you a little bit about them. They're both 5-day courses. In clinical trials, Paxlovid reduced hospitalizations and deaths by 88%. Now, that's something to sit up and take notice. It keeps you out of the hospital, as do vaccinations. But for the fully vaccinated and older people, knowing or anyone with these conditions, you know, you may be eligible. And if you've got the ones I listed, you are. As more becomes available, this drug's going to be very widely used, I would predict. But it's interesting because it's a combination of two drugs. And one of those drugs, the active one that goes after the COVID, was not working because it was broken down too quickly by the liver. So you couldn't give enough to anybody for it to get a high enough blood level. So they thought, well, what if we slow down the liver? So they added a second drug. And that the job of that second drug is to interfere with the breakdown of the first drug by the liver. Great so far, very clever, but it creates a problem because that same liver enzyme pathway that breaks down the active agent in Paxlovid, which is called Nirmatrelvir, Ritonavir is the active agent, and Nirmatrelvir is the one that inhibits the CYP3A metabolism. But, okay, so I got them flipped. Give me a break. The point is, amiodarone and other antiarrhythmic drugs, rifampin, the statins, and one of the blood-thinning agents for atrial fibrillation, Xarelto, all of those very messed up when mixed with this. So major drug interactions, the kind of drug interactions that can go sideways fast. So it's going to be easy to screw up prescribing this drug. And I'm going to be on tiptoe, believe me, if I do have occasion to try to prescribe it, to make sure that I check those interactions. And this is just the ones that we know about because of how they're metabolized. You throw herbs and other agents that might also have like St. John's wort, that might also have an effect on this pathway. And start taking antifungals for your toenail fungus, and this could be really disastrous. So we're going to have to take people off every drug we can if we give them to do this, and certainly it's fine to stop statins. The other drug is called Molrirapir, and it reduced hospital deaths 30%. Not bad, but it doesn't have nearly the number of drug interactions. That's good, but oops, it may actually cause mutations in human DNA. So unlike, say, acyclovir, which does not affect human DNA, this particular antiviral can. And the mutations in human DNA are just in cell culture. But boy, don't take this if you're pregnant. Don't take it if you're breastfeeding. And oh, by the way, it appears to get into sperm. So don't use it if you're thinking of creating a baby in the next 3 months with that sperm. Because that's their shelf life, by the way. And here's the other problem with these drugs right now. As I said, they're in short supply, and there's just not sufficient oversight to make sure that these drugs get to where they can do the most good. There's not a way to be sure, for example, that disadvantaged populations will get their fair share. There's not a way to make sure that a sort of gray market doesn't spring up because people of privilege and wealth find a way to access them before they really should. It's really up to the ethics of the doctors and the pharmacists. And to quote the orange one, I hear many of them are very nice people. But yeah, I'm worried that we've got progress, but it's progress with a price. One of the more transformational technologies in the last 50 years are MRI machines. But they are expensive and very resource intensive. To set up an MRI machine, first of all, there's cost. They cost about $1 to $3 million, and you have to have a substantial infrastructure issues. They need something called a RF shielding cage. They use a lot of energy. They require special wiring. And boy, it's a lot to ask a third world country to come up with. The University of Hong Kong has been looking at ultra-low frequency MRI technology, and they're trying to get MRIs into hospitals in Africa, in middle-income countries, and surgical suites and emergency rooms. And boy, would that be great, because getting an MRI in the middle of the night is very difficult in most places in the United States. So I mentioned the high-field superconducting MRIs are very expensive, and this new technology is ultra-low frequency. It uses a magnet-based, low-cost, low-noise, and low-power MRI scanner that you can run on 110. You can run off of a plug in a standard outlet. And they think it could be built for under $20,000, which starts to look really, really legitimate. It uses one of the rare earth metals, samarium, which I had to look up, by the way. The atomic number is 62. It's been very, very hard to extract because it's only present in very, very low levels, which is why one of the reasons I've never heard of it. There's a whole lot of stuff there on the periodic table that I know nothing about, but I always welcome the opportunity to learn something. This stuff can now be extracted and concentrated and used with cobalt to make a really good battery. And this battery will power this thing, allowing for the formation of imagings. And then they run the images through something called an electromagnetic interference cancellation technique, which basically gets rid of a whole bunch of the internal and external noise. Because they can process out the noise, they no longer need the high, ultra-high frequency. They don't need as powerful an image. It's very similar to the sort of technology that you've got on your phone or in, you know, Photoshop or Lightroom or whatever you're using for your own photographs to, you know, take out noise if you take a picture at night. And there's all the little speckly things in the black field. Or improve the focus, sharpen your image. Same kind of technology, but applied to this ultra-low frequency MRI image, which really improves the resolution sufficiently to find, for example, tumors. And I'm looking right here at two images. And yeah, it's much blurrier. The resolution is poor. It's a fuzzy image, but it's a brain tumor, no question about it. And if you could find that brain tumor in a middle-income country, you would save a life, because that's not going to get figured out unless you can ship the person off for imaging. The other major advantage of this is that we can use this to take pictures of people who have metallic implants. So suppose you've had a cerebrovascular stent. Suppose you have metallic clips, like you had an aneurysm clipped. Right now, you put that person in an MRI with that metal in their head, and the metal is going to heat up and it's going to try to spin. Oh, no bueno. So we rarely do MRIs. It's kind of a disqualifier. It's contraindicated. With this one, it's not. So it gives us the chance to get a lower resolution but still effective image in people who otherwise couldn't get an MRI at all. That piece of it, plus the $20,000 price tag, I think, is going to lead to rapid scaling of this technology, which means it's going to get to that $20,000 price because everybody's going to buy one and put an order, and they'll be able to make the investment and build the factories. A little functional medicine and biochemistry now, because why not, right? Everything you need to know about Nrf2 and sulforaphane. An alternative title to this might be Shut Up and Eat Your Broccoli Sprouts, because that turns out to be the best source of this majorly good nutritional element. Let's start at the beginning. We live in a toxic world, and you can only avoid so much. We have epidemiological evidence up the creek showing us that Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, other neurodegenerative conditions are linked to environmental toxins. We have the small particles. The recent fires in California and Washington State caused dangerous levels of air pollution. And, you know, healthy people of all ages get that stuff down into their lungs, but it also gets into, it's so small it can actually get into the bloodstream. These smallest particles are smaller, way smaller than a red blood cell. So they can basically get in it and go anywhere, and they are highly, highly inflammatory. They cause inflammation. They cause accelerated aging. Microplastics, well, they've found microplastics in the Himalayas. They're everywhere. They've gotten into the food chain. They've gotten into the ocean. And, you can look for BPA-free plastics. They're still plastics. They probably got other stuff in them that is equally bad for you. Just hasn't been as well researched. And we're looking at global climate change. We're looking at a time when, if anything, the toxicity that we're exposed to is going to get worse. Now, our bodies have a real amazing pathway called Nrf2, like a Nerf ball, except without the E, Nrf-2. And the Nrf2 is a transcription factor. It's a pathway that gets turned on at the cell wall from the exposure to pro-oxidant, pro-inflammatory, and toxic agents. This Nrf2 keep pathway complex goes into the nucleus and it turns on the DNA. It binds to the genes that contain all of the antioxidant response elements, and it binds to genes that are involved in both phases of detoxification. And the real one we're after is that phase two detoxification, where you get rid of xenobiotics, that's your bisphenol A, that's your pesticides, and endobiotics. That's the things that's the stuff that we produce ourselves that's pro-inflammatory, or that comes in what we eat, or what the bacteria that are in our sinuses are excreting into our system. Basically, all of phase two involves taking a reactive molecule and sticking something on it. You can stick glutathione on it. You can stick glucose on it. You can stick a glucose-like molecule called glucuronidate. You can stick an acetyl group, which is just two carbons and a CH3. And sulfur. All of these things will actually take stuff out of your body. You can also reduce quinones, which are highly reactive compounds one of which actually can come from our own natural estrogen and testosterone. And all of these things are like sparks in a barn. They're just waiting to start a fire in your body. So turning on NRF, detecting those sparks and turning on NRF2 is really key. Now, there's been studies looking at the risks of and damage of diesel exhaust. And if you can increase NRF2 expression, you reduce that. So if you live within 100 feet of a road, you're definitely looking at breathing diesel. It enhances this. It reduces the inflammation in the lungs and the airways. So it's good for people with asthma. It's good for people who have reactive asthma especially. And there's a study where they gave sulforaphane, which is a very good activator of NRF2, and they really improved asthmatics. So it works in humans. There's another study looking at 200 grams of broccoli sprouts. It's not that much, right? That's, you know, basically about between 7 ounces of broccoli sprouts. That actually really worked well to reduce inflammation associated with allergies in people with allergic asthma. And so they actually did bronchial lavage to prove that the stuff had a beneficial effect. Another interesting thing about the NRF2 is it turns on a couple of things that are active viral inhibitors. So they go into the cytoplasm and inhibit the replication of a bunch of viruses, including SARS-CoV, herpes, 1 and 2, vaccinia virus, and Zika virus. And it's an interferon-independent mechanism. It hasn't been well characterized, but this is huge news. So not only are they anti-inflammatory and pro-detoxification, but they're actually antiviral. So how are we going to get this stuff? Well, now we're getting into the science of broccoli sprouts. So the precursor to this stuff is glucoraphanin. And within the broccoli sprouts, there's an enzyme called myrosinase that actually, it's the same thing with garlic, actually. When you cut into garlic, you enzymatically break down a compound in the garlic and you release allicin. And allicin's the good stuff that does all the good things that we talk about with garlic. Well, this is essentially the same thing. You break down this glucoraphanin and it turns into sulforaphane. You can also get, so chewing your broccoli sprouts or crushing them, which would include putting them in your blender and your shake and drinking them, are really great ways to get this going. I would say the way I would do it is I'd put the broccoli sprouts in the blender, pulse that a few times, you know, check your watch for 30 seconds, and then throw the rest of the stuff in. Give that enzyme a chance to work on the mush so that you get the maximum reaction and don't dilute it. But you can also, if you are a, you know, chew-chew gulp person like me, I know. I don't practice what I preach in that regard. But you can catalyze that with your good microbiome. So your microbiome, again, once more to the rescue. So eating raw broccoli sprouts provides a very, very good source of glycosinolates and therefore sulforaphane. If you cook the broccoli or the broccoli sprouts, and we're talking 70 degrees centigrade, so you don't even have to get to boiling to inactivate the myrosinase. So what do we want? We want broccoli seeds and broccoli and 3-day-old broccoli sprouts. They've got a ton more of this, up to 100 times more than mature broccoli heads. So we want raw. We want to chew it. And it's an incredibly useful thing. Now, there are some supplements that are available, and called Crucera, which I believe is made by a company called Thorne, is when I do want to use it, that's the one I use. It's expensive. And I know that I'm not sure that it's going to substitute because it's hard to know how stable whether you can stabilize this molecule. Anytime you've got a complicated molecule, Can you actually take that complicated molecule, concentrate it, manage to get it into a powder or a goo that you can then put in a capsule? That's a big ask. And I don't know if the supplement I'm recommending has data that's effective. I haven't been able to find published data, but I think I'm going to write to the company and ask them what they think about this article, having read it. But I hope you've enjoyed it and have been persuaded that it's time to buy some broccoli seeds and figure out a way to eat them or make broccoli sprouts. By the way, I can't buy them fast enough. They're always sold out or almost sold out at my local markets. So if you're lucky enough to score some, put some in a salad and chew it up. Our next story is, let's see, what have we got? We've got 10 minutes. Let's talk about ancient DNA. And ALS, because this is, I thought, was a very, very interesting article. This started out as one of those things that happen, you know, by coincidence, and an observant doctor figures it out. So in this case, the doctor was Avendra Nath, who was running an HIV clinic. And in 2000, someone came in who appeared to be showing symptoms of ALS. He was already had HIV and was on and he also had worsening HIV. So the doctor put him on antiretroviral drugs, and his ALS improved. It improved a lot. So the doctor went to the medical literature, and he found other reports of people with HIV and ALS whose ALS symptoms actually improved with drugs that stopped the viruses from replicating. Now, we've known for a long time that there is viral DNA sitting in the human genome. So every time our cells in the ovary divide to make a new egg, that viral DNA is along for the ride. And most of it is sitting in place. It's sitting sort of hibernating. But the question is, can it wake up? And under what circumstances does it? I mean, what's the scoop with herpes, right? It wakes up, or chickenpox. It wakes up and causes, you know, an outbreak on the skin. There's been speculation for a long time that multiple sclerosis, schizophrenia, and maybe even type 1 diabetes might in some cases be triggered by these ancient viruses waking up and starting to make copies of themselves, which then, just like we, you know, put the COVID, like the COVID vaccine, right? You put the RNA in the cell, makes the thing, the immune system sees the thing and goes after it. Well, what if that thing is a virus that's been living in the genome for millennia, centuries, millions of years? These retrovirus reactive things, we know they can cause cancer. There's something called Rous sarcoma virus, a retrovirus which inserts a copy into the DNA of cells, and it causes tumors in chickens. And following Koch's hypothesis, is this causal? Someone took a small piece of tumor from the first Rous chicken that showed up, a Plymouth Rock hen, as it happens, in New York in 1910. And that little piece of tumor was transplanted into other chickens, and they all developed the cancer. But they had mushed it up, and they had filtered out all the cells and filtered out all the bacteria. So it was hyper filtered. The only thing that could get through was a virus. And that's how they found the Rous sarcoma virus. But, of course, viral DNA, if it happens to infect the sperm or the egg, that's going to get into the genome and be passed down. And so it looks like the earliest retroviruses start, well, somewhere around 500 million years ago. And 8%, this blew my mind, 8% of the human genome is retrovirus. So most of them don't, they can't, you know, come back. They're inert, they're semi-degraded, they're full of mutations because they've been sitting there not being error corrected, because that the human system does not spend time error correcting non-human DNA. But certain circumstances, two different families can wake up and start producing viral proteins that can activate the immune system. And some of the first evidence came from people with multiple sclerosis. And they found a MS-associated retrovirus, and it's called HERV. It's human endogenous retrovirus W, because there's a lot of them. We see that this amount of virus predicts the disease progression. So some people's, if you look in the blood for this mutated virus, in the case of multiple sclerosis, the more they've got, the faster the disease is going to progress and the worse the disease is going to be. And about the same time, this is now 2005 that we're talking about, the same virus got implicated in schizophrenia. Somebody did CSF puncture, you know, did spinal lumbar punctures to get CSF in people with schizophrenia, and they found a retroviral protein in them. And then, of course, we talk about the ALS. Well, there's a retroviral protein called HERV-K that's in every single one. Now, this is a link in a chain. It doesn't tell us what activates the virus. And really, that's the thing. Now that we understand that some of these very difficult to treat diseases are triggered by retroviruses, we now want to figure out how to untrigger them. Turns out the mechanism for this Pol protein is probably messing with the microglia, which are also fundamental in Alzheimer's disease. So this is non-infectious. You have to understand, you can't catch ALS and you can't catch schizophrenia because these viruses aren't able to become infectious no matter what. But what they are is alarming to the immune system, and so they set off a whole chain reaction of things. So we think at this point that both the virus has to reactivate and you have to have DNA in your system that elsewhere that is going to create a protein that the antibody that the virus triggers is going to attack. So this is a little bit like an autoimmune situation, like the myocarditis that we're seeing in a small percentage of people who get COVID. And it's always young men because they're the ones who are running around and doing all the physical activity while they've got a load of virus in their system, because get them to lie in bed. Good luck, unless, you know, they're not alone. But the point is, this is a really important thing for us to understand and fund research, because this could be the key to a lot of the worst diseases that are still on the table as, oh, well, too bad, so sad, including, for that matter, the fibromuscular dysplasia. What if that's a retrovirus? It absolutely could be. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.